Hello and welcome to the Special Science Podcast from the 2010 AAAS Annual Meeting in San Diego, California. It's February 22nd. I'm Robert Frederick. In this short podcast, we'll hear about the health and new genetic issues of children of assisted reproductive technologies. For prospective parents, the inability to have children can be heart-wrenching. Many are willing to spend a lot of time and money to overcome their infertility, and for decades, medical advances have allowed otherwise apparently infertile people to have children of their own. But by bypassing what may be one of nature's ways of filtering out unsuccessful genetic mutations, keeping infertile people childless, the question is, might we be creating a larger population of infertile people? The children born with assisted reproductive technologies.
The answer to that is maybe yes.
André van Stertegem is a medical doctor and consultant to the Brussels Free University Center for Reproductive Medicine in Belgium.
It's for sure that there are genetic causes of infertility that you can bypass now by this. But that may mean that the next generation may be infertile as well. And this is something I think that all clinics should mention to the patients, that if there is a genetic origin, that this genetic origin of infertility may be transmitted to the next generation.
To study this and any other health and genetic issues, van Stertegem and colleagues started a follow-up program to study the children of assisted reproductive technologies.
It has to be considered the health of the children as the most important outcome parameter of all infertility treatment. I'm sure you know the background of infertility treatment. We are today February 2010, and since the 25th of July 1978, the birth date of Louise Brown, it's fair to say that several millions of children have been born worldwide after assisted reproductive technology. In some countries, this represents 3 to 5% even of all births.
And with that many births, the concern is that if those children also need assisted reproductive technologies, or ART, to have children, then the percentage of the population who are infertile goes up.
But you should note that this kind of Pandora's box argument is not peculiar to ART, right?
Carmen Sapienza is a pathologist at Temple University Medical School in Philadelphia.
So, for instance, we're increasing the frequency of retinoblastoma mutations in the population right now because what you can tell prenatally, whether by preimplantation diagnosis, whether an individual is going to have a mutation in the retinoblastoma gene. Now, 60 years ago, 70 years ago, these children all died before they were 5 or 6 or 7 years old, right? But now they take them directly from the delivery room and they laser out those microtumors in their eyes and before, so now they can see, they're fertile, they can, so this is happening, I think, as a general result of, sort of understanding genetics.
But Sapienza says the epigenetics aren't so clear.
One thing that epigenetics involves, or at least one of the major questions is how does the environment interact with your genome? So most human traits have very broad ranges, and people, they always say, okay, well, both genes and environment are involved. And so this is one way, by changing epigenetic marks, that the environment could interact with your genome. And so assisted reproduction presented a clear case of where there was a clear difference in environment between individuals conceived by assisted reproduction who spent their first 3 days in a petri dish in the incubator in 20% oxygen, and other kids conceived in the traditional fashion who spent their first 3 days or the rest of it in mom in 5% oxygen. And so the question became, from animal models, there are clear effects of doing this in mouse embryos and sheep embryos, et cetera. There are clear effects of doing this. And so we asked kind of a very simple question. This is, if you collect a sample of kids who are conceived by assisted reproduction, collect a sample of kids who are conceived in vivo, and you compare their epigenetic marks, are there differences? The answer is yes. And do these differences result in differences in gene expression? The answer is yes. And so the question is, what effect does this have? Well, again, you look at the kids who are born from assisted reproduction, by and large, they are just fine, right? So it's not like the kids have extra arms or extra heads or anything. It's just they have a small risk for other undesirable outcomes. But the factors are, factors of 2 or 3. They're not factors of 10 or 20. And so when you ask about these kids, you say, well, okay, so what's going to happen to them down the line? Remember, none of them is older than 30. And so epidemiologically, one of the things that is true of kids who conceived of assisted reproduction is that they have a much higher frequency of being low birth weight. And epidemiologically, if you happen to be in that bottom 10% of, you know, kids who are born with very low birth weight, then this conversely results in a higher tendency to be obese, to have type 2 diabetes, and to have hypertension when you become 50 years old. So I think that we're kind of doing an experiment here. We've got a big cohort of kids who, the vast majority of them, even though it's been 30 years since we've had assisted reproduction be successful, the vast majority of these kids are younger than 20.
In other words, it's too early to tell if there will be widespread infertility or other health or genetic issues among children of assisted reproductive technology. And even if scientists could enroll all of them in a study, we don't yet know enough about what causes health or genetic issues in the first place. Dolores Lamb is a urologist at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. She studies infertility in men.
Nearly one quarter, and some people would argue as much as one half of all male infertility is diagnosed as idiopathic, meaning we don't understand the etiology. This really represents our poor understanding of the mechanisms that regulate sperm production by the testis, the maturation and transit of sperm through the male and female genital tracts, and the events required for fertilization and early embryonic development. So we cannot properly diagnose these men.
Though that's not for a lack of trying, Lamb says, even with the latest genetic tests.
So we can do a karyotype analysis to look at chromosomes. This would be analogous to looking at the Encyclopedia Britannica and saying that all the volumes are present and they're about the right size. But it doesn't tell you anything about whether you have missing chapters or misspelled words, all of which could have very profound effects and cause male infertility. So we can do a karyotype analysis, we can do a Y chromosome microdeletion test, and we can test for the cystic fibrosis mutations in men with congenital bilateral absence of the vas deferens. So we really don't have the tools to properly diagnose these genetic defects.
And when couples seek out medical assistance to have children, very often doctors bypass a full evaluation of male infertility, particularly with in vitro fertilization, or IVF.
So, for example, just because you have a normal semen analysis with sperm that swim properly does not mean that the sperm could penetrate the egg, right? If the sperm can't bind to the egg, if we think about kind of a hormone and a receptor or a cell-cell interaction, then you will never get fertilization, even though you have sperm that swim fine in the proper numbers and everything else. There are defects like this, but I would say the bigger problem is that there are correctable causes also of male infertility, which if the male is not evaluated, cannot be fixed. And most couples would rather have a naturally conceived child, and it's a cheaper option for them. And then finally, male infertility can also be associated with, you know, very deadly illnesses where the first indication that the patient is seen for is an infertility evaluation. So again, if we bypass this, which is what happens very frequently in IVF groups, then, you know, again, the diagnosis of that male is tremendously delayed.
And all of those concerns, plus those for women undergoing fertility treatments and often a risky pregnancy, coupled with the concerns for the health and genetic makeup of the future child, can make prospective parents anxious. But there is one thing that doctors and prospective parents can do to reduce the health risks of children conceived with medical assistance.
And it's simple to do it. You just replace one embryo.
Again, André van Stertegem of the Brussels Free University Center for Reproductive Medicine.
Above all, we should try to reduce what I have called the iatrogenic epidemic of multiple pregnancy.
And that's because multiple births typically mean lower birth weights for each child, which in turn are associated with more diseases as the children grow up. Carmen Sapienza says it will take some time to figure out anything else.
So we see differences between the kids, but it's comparing one group to another. Amongst the group of kids who are conceived in vitro, there are parents who are infertile for genetic reasons. There are parents who are infertile for sort of physical reasons. And this is, we don't have the answer yet, and we're not going to for a while. But there are some controls you can do. So there are individuals who are infertile as a result of tubal ligation. Right, and so they're an individual who used to be fertile, and then they've had tubal ligation, and then now so they're not fertile anymore, so they have in vitro fertilization because they're not able to reverse the tubal ligation. But again, it's going to take a while to sort this out.
This has been a Special Science Podcast and concludes our coverage from the 2010 AAAS Annual Meeting in San Diego, California. Special thanks to Karina Wu for her work on this show. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.